When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly, and welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report, broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center in downtown Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. You can check us out on the web at internetlawcenter.net. And from time to time, we do special editions that are off topic, in addition to our author series in connection with the Miami Book Fair that will begin shortly again. And November, we'll be commemorating the centennial of the armistice from World War I, a war that helped shape the United States' identity, and its impact is still being felt today. Today is the centennial of the last major offensive of the war that helped bring it to an end, but at a steep price. 117,000 casualties and over 26,000 Americans were killed in that battle, including my great uncle, Thomas Kelly. So joining us today is Jonathan Casey, the Director of Archives in the Edward Jones Research Center at the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City. And as usual, you can find our show notes at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com and follow us on Twitter at cyberlawradio. So, Mr. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. You're welcome.
And so I guess, like any story, we should begin at the beginning, but maybe let's start with the story of World War One. It has many layers, but as does the story of your museum, and let's why don't we start there? Tell us how the World War One Museum came about, and particularly why it's in Kansas City.
Yes, it's a layered story. It started right at the as the armistice was happening in November 1918, and there was an editorial in one of the papers saying that Kansas City should build a memorial to those who served and, of course, sacrificed. And it was meant for Kansas City, Missourians, but by extension, more than that. But this was in the paper, and people got the idea going. And there were meetings right after the armistice, which was November 11th, civic meetings, civic leaders, business leaders got together, and we had some public meetings and discussed what kind of memorial, what should be done. And eventually the idea came about to have a memorial itself, a structure memorializing the event, also a museum building, something practical in nature where people could come and look at the objects and things, and look at what the soldiers had and what and so forth, so they could learn from it. So this was voted on. There was just a kind of a citywide ballot on this, and people said, yeah, they want a memorial in a museum. Then they went into the public subscription phase, which was in 1919, which they raised money, and they based this on the Liberty Loan campaigns where people would go out into neighborhoods and ask people to donate money toward Liberty Loan. So they had this subscription, and they within like 10 days they raised over $2 million, and 2 million for the structure itself, and about half a million for other causes that were related to the war, to help pay off debts of organizations that had supported the war. So they had this large amount of money in about 10 days time, which is, I don't know, today's like 40 million or something.
Wow.
And then like 80,000 some people contributed. And we have these cards in our archives that are just cards that have how much you're going to donate and, you know, the address, all pre-printed cards and thousands of these things. And they've been scanned, so they're digitized. But people give whatever amount, could be a dollar or could be $5 or whatever. So they raised this money, and there was an architectural competition in 21 or so through in that time. And then there was architects were invited who were interested in doing memorials, people who were architects for that kind of architecture, memorials and monumental buildings and things, public buildings, and an architect named Harold Van Buren McGonigal won this competition, and he went ahead and the construction on it was started about 1923, and there was a cornerstone ceremony and these different ceremonies, and then it opened up in 26. Excuse me. I will say in 1921, the site dedication happened here, where General John Pershing, who was from Laclede, Missouri, which is not far from Kansas City, he and four other commanders representing the Allies, the British and the French, the Belgians, the Italians, were here for the third annual American Legion Convention. The American Legion started in World War One, and they were here in Kansas City the end of October, 1st of November of 1921. They dedicated the site to about 100,000 people, the largest crowd at the time in Kansas City, and it was across from the Union Station, the train station here in Kansas City, one of the biggest in the country. So they had the site dedication. There was like a cornerstone dedication. Then there was 1926, President Coolidge was here to dedicate the memorial, the structure itself. That's when it opened to the public. And he was President of the United States and sort of brought his, he said, the authority of the federal government to make it the national memorial and monument and so forth to the war. So we got started by a big civic effort and a grassroots campaign effort and all that to build this. And there was the museum itself and with the objects in it from veterans from the area, but also some from foreign governments. And then there was a building that was sort of meant as a meeting hall for the Liberty Memorial Association, the organization that was formed to create the memorial, and also for veterans organizations, like American Legion or whatever, Veterans of Foreign Wars. So there was these two buildings, the tower itself and the courtyard and all the whole structure itself. And then over the years, there was the landscaping and everything, and a sculptural frieze, which is a kind of a bas-relief frieze that's on the north wall facing Union Station. It's one of the biggest anywhere, and that's a lot of symbolic about... a lot of symbolism in it about the going from war to peace and the various figures in that and different references to the Bible quotations from the Bible and from other sources. So there's a whole lot of things going on, a lot of symbolic architecture here within the whole structure. And that just went on to itself and from the 20s and the 30s and so forth and went on. But then... you know, things changed as we had the Second World War, just 20 years after the First World War, and then sort of things. The structure itself, in a way, was still vibrant. It still had ceremonies. It still had a purpose, and people would still visit. But it kind of lost some of its stature, I think, because of the Second World War, and then how just things changed over time. It was having some financial trouble, and eventually the city took it over. It was a private operation originally, then the city of Kansas City, Missouri took it over, and eventually the staff was hired, professional staff, curatorial staff, to help to do work with the collection and to create exhibitions and to do things in a proper museum. And it had to close for years. It was closed in the 90s because of structural deterioration. Then there was a sales tax passed, another grassroots effort in a way to renovate it, and it came back in 2002. And since then, it's really expanded, and we have a something like a 35,000 square foot museum space as the main gallery, and then we have other spaces. And we've just opened a gallery this year, about a 3,000 square foot gallery. And so really it's grown quite a bit, and I've been here some time and seen a lot of changes in it, and it's now a truly, besides national, but international museum, and telling the story not just of the Americans, what America did in the war, but everybody as much as possible, both sides of the conflict, and what their contributions were, and telling it through stories as much as possible, just of the average soldier, or the average factory worker, you know, involved in the war effort. So that's so, a lot there. I know it's a long story. Anyway, yeah.
So a lot of people, when they get a novel, or they sometimes peek at the ending. And so we're going to take a quick peek at the ending, since it's coming up soon. The war famously ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Yeah. And so you have the centennial of the armistice coming up on November 11th. What does the museum have planned?
A number of things, and it's sort of based on our regular ceremony that we have. But, of course, it's a special one this year, being the 100th anniversary. We'll have, it's an international ceremony. We'll have our speakers who represent different countries who are involved in the war. We'll have political speakers from the Kansas City area, from Missouri. There's going to be a wreath laying ceremony, and that's going to represent those who sacrificed. And from all over the world, so not just folks on the United States, and there'll be bells, sermon about bells, because when the armistice was declared, it was celebratory. I mean, this thing finally got over with after 4 years, you know, 4.5 years. So there'll be a bell, bells of peace, we're calling it. So there'll be that part of the ceremony. There's always the we'll have our walk of honor dedication, which is our granite bricks that are inscribed and that people purchase and in memory of somebody, either from the war, could be from any war. And we'll have a ceremony with that for the installation of the bricks. Some readings from those who were involved at the time. Again, whether it could be a soldier reading something, his response to the armistice, or it could be a nurse, or it could be somebody not in the military, somebody in political life, you know, or somebody well-known, reading something from that person's experience and that person's recollection of the armistice and experiencing it.
This would not be real veterans, since the last one died in 2011.
No, yeah, Frank Buckles, who died in 2011, no. And it's been, obviously, it's called Veterans Day. I mean, it's been Veterans Day
for a while,
You know, since the 50s, and that was in October, and then they did make an adjustment some time ago. The government changed it to November 11th because it's the symbolism of it. But I think we're going to call it more just Armistice Day, at least for this year, because it is the centennial. It's special. So we're going to focus more on the origin of it, and that it came, where it came from, and we're the National Museum for that conflict. So we're the representative of it, and so it's sort of the general. You always got to have sort of basic elements to a ceremony, you know what I mean. But it's going to be a special thing.
And there's often poppies associated with World War One commemoration. Why is that?
Yes. That's a poppy. The poppy is an iconic symbol of the war, of the loss of the war, and also then the rebirth. You know, these poppies are these flowers that grew all over Belgium and France, northern France, is what we're talking about geographically, in Flanders. So
right.
There was a poem written
Flanders
in 1915
Fields. Yeah.
In Flanders Fields by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, who was a Canadian physician serving with the Canadian Army in France. And he wrote it for a fellow officer who had died then in 1915, and it was part of the eulogy. And he read this poem. And it was published then, but didn't get a whole lot of attention. I mean, the war was still, it was really cranking up then. This was this was in the spring of 15 that he died. So the war was just almost getting started, how terrible it became. So anyway, it got the attention after the war. He died, McCrae died in January of 1918 of pneumonia. So he did not survive the war even. He died in service. And then after the war, it was picked up just as the symbol. I can't think of the woman's name offhand, but there was a woman in particular who was promoting it, who read the poem in Collier's magazine, and she was so inspired she went out and bought poppies from a florist and started handing them out and all this, and then she kind of led the effort about making it the symbol. But it was picked up as a symbol with Britain and France. Of course, McCrae was Canadian, Britain and Canada, but also so in Flanders Field was the poem.
Sure.
And it talks about the poppies blowing in the wind, the crosses row on row, the crosses of the dead, and then the poppies. So it's known here, we've called it, of course, Veterans Day or Armistice Day, but in Britain, Canada, it's Remembrance Day.
Right.
And that's a big thing. And we do have a good representation of poppies here. When you come to the museum, you have to cross over this chasm. You cross over on a glass bridge. And into the main gallery, so into the whole story of the war, you have to cross a field of poppies, of 9,000 poppies that represent 9 million combatant deaths.
Wow.
9 million, that's kind of the figure you always see about those who actually were involved in the fighting, 9 million, so it doesn't include civilians, which are several million, 5 million or something. But you cross over this poppy field, and then you have to cross over it again to leave the main gallery. So you're kind of thinking, what is this about?
Right.
What do these poppies mean?
Out.
And then you find out, or you kind of know, actually, that you can, the volunteers will tell you, the symbolism, but then you go through and you look at all the scenes of destruction and the sacrifice,
My wife is Canadian, and...
Oh, yeah.
And it struck me, and we'll get into this in a minute, because there really are two wars. Is from the European perspective, it's a war that begins in 1914 goes on, but for American experience, it's just a brief period, 1917, 1918, that we're involved.
Yeah.
But I remember the first time going to visit her family, and I was at some dinner with her aunts and uncles, and I'm sorry, I just bumped the mic. Everyone there could recite the poem on Flanders Field, and it just struck me how much this was part of their psyche, and how that was much more important. War in their history and how it's taught, whereas in our history we covered a little bit, and then boom, let's jump into World War II because that's the big story of American heroism and saving the world, but it also did so here in World War I. It did strike me, and it is a moving poem too. We shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders fields. So let's talk about the two wars. The war, it starts in 1914, famously, after the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand and of Austria-Hungary, and to get even more complicated, he was killed in Bosnia by a Serbian nationalist.
Yeah.
And then through this whole link of alliances, next thing you know, the entire all the European empires are at war.
Right, right. Yeah. And some people, it's hard to understand that. It's how all this could happen from that thing. But there was a lot of tension before the war, and there was you can read about the different themes. The arms race, the naval arms race specifically, that you could read about between Germany and Britain, and who was going to have a bigger navy, more powerful navy, because that was a navy meant that you were a global power.
Right.
Could go anywhere in the world, and these countries, Britain, France, Germany, and some others to some extent, had these maritime empires, these global empires that stretched the world, and they had colonies, these different continents, and that was a sign of power and prestige, a sign of national prestige to have these colonies. And also it's economic reasons, the resources from these colonies, but it was just all together, and so this was a sign of power, and there had been between France and Germany, there had been a lot of tension, a lot of animosity going back hundreds of years, these different conflicts that they had. There was between France and Britain even. It's very complicated. Russia was part of it because Russia was wanting, they were always enlarging their territory and they were always trying to project their power into Europe. Russia was kind of different. They're sort of on the outside, but they're also a part of Europe and want to be involved in that. And they had, they were joined with France because France needed an alliance with Russia. This was before the war. This was in the 1890s because France had been defeated by Germany in the Franco-Prussian War, and then France lost territory, and then France needed some allies. And, you know, all these alliances, all this was developing for the years before the war. And then there was all this trouble. They say in the Balkans, there was a saying about the war would start there because there was all this, the tensions in the Balkan states that you mentioned, like Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, and those states.
In fact, Bismarck had predicted that in 1888. He said if it's going to be, it's going to happen there. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll come back. Sure. We'll jump right into the war and what it meant for the United States and for the other countries. You're listening to CyberLaw and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the CyberLaw and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
It's time once again to get ready for the 35th Annual Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Learn more at MiamiBookFair.com. Over 500 authors will be coming in from all over the world to read their books, answer questions from the audience, and sign autographs. Award-winning luminaries confirmed to attend this year include novelists like Elliot Ackerman, Robert Olin Butler, Ingrid Rojas Contreras, and Deborah Dean. Nonfiction writers like Dr. Mark Agronin, Muhammad Al-Samawi, Andrea Barnett, and Tina Brown. Celebrities like Justine Bateman, Steve Kornacki, Bill Press. These are just a few of the confirmed 500 authors scheduled to appear at the 2018 Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Check out the full schedule of events right now at MiamiBookFair.com. That's MiamiBookFair.com.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking about World War I with Jonathan Casey. He's the director of archives in the Edward Jones Research Center at the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri. It is Missouri, right? You're not on the Kansas side.
It is okay. Missouri. Yeah, thanks for saying that.
Just wanted to be careful. Don't want to offend anybody. So let's kind of just do a snapshot. At the start of World War I, it wouldn't be hard for people to imagine today, but the United States was not exactly a superpower. In fact, I think I saw some statistic of we had the 17th largest military at the start of the war, behind Serbia. When we entered the war, I saw some statistic that we had a total of 55 planes, and 51 of them weren't functioning. I mean, it's kind of not to say Keystone Cops, but we weren't exactly, well, there was this arms race going on in Europe. We weren't exactly part of that party.
No. We had a real small military establishment. excuse me. It was small because we didn't feel that we needed it. I mean, traditionally, we always had a small establishment unless we had a big war like the Civil War. So, you know, because we had two oceans.
Exactly.
Protecting us. So we had one of the largest navies. We had a big navy. I mean, and we had the Panama Canal open just as the war got started. It opened, I think, in October of 14. You know, that was a way of facilitating to move a fleet from one ocean to the other ocean, you know, back and forth. So we were aware of things strategically. We were aware of the situation in Europe. It wasn't like we were isolated in our thinking or anything. It was just we didn't feel the need for it. Now, we ended up supplying lots of whatever to the Allies. I mean, they came over here, purchase agents, and bought lots of stuff, a lot of gunpowder, you know, a lot of munitions, mules. Specifically, I'm going to say mules because a lot came from Missouri, but a lot of, you know, animal power, transport. And so a lot of everything, but a lot of ammunition and things. And so we were involved in, even though as a neutral, our companies were selling it, you know, we were making money. So, that's true. That's the situation, but we were small in the military establishment because we didn't feel the need for anything more than what we had.
So, let me just jump forward a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you have these, you know, we're a relatively young country. So by 1914, we were about 150 years old as a country. And maybe just through the Spanish-American War that it concluded, you know, a generation earlier, are starting to, you know, see ourselves at the world stage. Also at this time, we're a country of immigrants. I think at this point, one-third of the population was either an immigrant or first-generation American. And what you see, and this also plays out in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, that this war has an effect of defining nationhood for those countries. You know, Canada wins a decisive battle. Canadian troops win the decisive battle in 1918, and it's really heralded as a defining point in Canadian identity.
You
have the tragedy of the failed assault at Gallipoli, which Churchill was behind, and you know that becomes a defining moment for the Australian and New Zealand troops who really led that effort. And then, in a sense, for the United States, you have this by the time they got brought into the war, and we'll get into that in a minute. They pull together this disparate forces of people from all over the world. And I saw one commentator say that this is when we went from being Italian American, Irish Americans, Chinese American to Americans. It removed the hyphen from American identity.
That is true. How we saw our place in the world, I think it's kind of as a refuge for a lot of people in this, and we were a young country, relatively young and growing, and we had a lot of power, with our natural resources, even in our growing population and industrialization, and we were focused more on developing us, throughout the 19th century, really developing the interior and creating this country, this manifest destiny. And you mentioned Spanish-American War. We had reached out, for various reasons anyway, thought it was necessary to get involved in that. So we did have overseas possessions. So we did have something of our own maritime empire, actually, and I mentioned that with the European powers.
Right.
And, we had so that was another reason to create this power, this naval power. Back to that, and Teddy Roosevelt was instrumental in that because he was real big on naval power. That a book about naval powers that was published by a Naval Academy instructor was very influential on his thinking. So that was something that he was focused on, and I mentioned the Panama Canal and everything. It's so you know, we weren't a superpower. We weren't even really necessarily interested in being that, but it was something we were engaged with the world, you know, and economically, and we were involved, but just still kind of coming out of what our focus had been just internally. And then, you know, with this war came out and happened, and this and how things developed, and there was a lot of debate about why should we get into the war? You know, it's not our business.
Right.
And you know, what let them fight it out. No one thought it was going to last as long as it did anyway. You know, really, that's what the politicians and the military leaders, most of them, were telling the people, you know, well, this, we're going to win, our side's going to win, and, you know, they always say 6 weeks or by Christmas or something.
Right.
You know, we're going to get this thing done with. The businessmen and the economists, these people are saying, well, gee, you know, if it did last longer, that's going to bankrupt us. We can't run this thing longer. We're going to run out of money. I mean, it's not going to work. I mean, no one had any idea, except there were a few, but no one, I think, had any idea really how big it could get or long. But there was a few, and a particular name was Kitchener. You may know that name, who was the British Secretary of War, who was this very well-known, this famous British soldier, had fought all over in the British Empire, all places, and was just like this iconic British officer, Horatio Kitchener. And he'd had an inkling that something, it was going to be bigger than that. That's the one person that I'm aware of that really kind of understood it, and said, you know, we've got to create a huge army. Britain was kind of like us, where they had a small professional army, and they increased it because they relied on their Navy, kind of like we would. But he said, we're going to need a lot more people in this. This is going to take a long time. So they started a lot of effort on volunteers, and they didn't want to use conscription. That was always a dicey thing in Britain, and it never happened in Australia. Canada did to some extent, but you know, it was these armies. But they were, again, this, it was kind of like a European continental war between France and Germany primarily.
Right, that we weren't really invited to.
Yeah, well, that we wanted to stay out of. But Wilson, President Wilson said, well, I'm going to stay out of this. He ran, you know, his 1916 election was, he said it wouldn't get involved. He ran on a peace platform, and he was just trying to, he could do what he could do to negotiate something. If he could help out, arbitrate some final decision, he'd want to do that. But he didn't want to get in the war. He was really, it just wasn't... to him, I think it was just something that he didn't think America should be involved in. There were people from the start, like Teddy Roosevelt, said, yeah, we got to get into it. We got to get in the fight. And, you know, we got to prove to people that, you know, we're manly and all. So, you know, we're going to get in and we're going to make a difference. But Wilson ran on peace. He kept us out of the war with the slogans and all that. And there was a large population. You mentioned immigrants. There was a lot of German Americans,
people of German ancestry, especially in the U.S.
Especially in the Midwest.
Right.
Excuse me. There's a lot of Irish, more so I would say in the urban areas. So there's a lot of Irish who were anti-British, you know, who had come over here starting in the 1840s with the potato famine, and had so they didn't. There was an issue with them, and that was a lot of Democratic voters were these groups, and you know, again, Wilson. But I don't know that much about his decision making, so I don't get into that. But there was, in his cabinet and everything, there was dissension, you know, to get in or not to get in. And eventually these certain things happened that he said, no, we've got to do this. It's the moral thing to do, that, you know, we're going to fight the war. Then you think about to make the world safe for democracy. You hear a phrase like that, you know, things like, so let's idealize it. Yeah.
Let's step back a minute. So the war starts and Germany goes on the offensive. They invade Belgium.
Yeah.
And just, you know, wholesale destroy towns along the way, and which causes a great moral outrage. And and they start advancing in Paris, and their whole plan, as you mentioned, was that this is going to be a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And that, you know, just to reach Paris quickly, and that would be the end of the war.
Yeah.
And they almost succeeded. They came within, like I read something, they came within 30 kilometers of Notre Dame, the cathedral in Paris. And they were stopped at the Marne River, and and then became a 3 or 4 year stalemate at there, where they both just dug into and started building this network of trenches that spanned, you know, 400 miles, and so, you know, yes, it almost was quick, but then then you saw this kind of new kind of warfare, this trench warfare.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, well, I was going to say, yeah, and that's the general idea. It was a war of movement in the first few months, and then it got bogged down because of just the weapons and the enormity of the armies and trying to squeeze a whole bunch of people into a fairly small space, and you got machine guns going off everywhere and heavy artillery and, you know, people trying to scramble for cover. So then they right in the trenches, and then this no man's land came about. And that's also, there's, you think about the Eastern Front, it's a similar situation, but a lot of fighting on the Eastern Front and other fronts, you know, and that we focus on the Western because that's where America pretty much did its part. And we think about it because we think of France and we think of Britain and so forth. But there was lots of this going on in the East between Russia and Germany and Russia and Austria-Hungary. And then eventually the Italians joined in 1915. And there's a lot of fighting in the mountains. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, the terrain in the Dolomites and everything and what was going on.
And then those battles in Africa,
Africa,
various possessions, and in the Middle East.
In the Middle East, and then between the Ottoman Turks fighting with the British and with the Arabs and the obviously there's a world war and everywhere. And in the Far East, Japan was an ally. And Japan attacked the German possessions in China. And seized those, and then that's for another discussion about future of Japan's aggrandizement. And Japan's enlarging their territory,
right?
And what became their then what they did to the later on in the Far East during the 20s and the 30s, especially, and then the leading up to World War II, leading up to Pearl Harbor. So. And then the Polynesia, the islands and everything, that all these different countries had islands in the Pacific, including us, with the Philippines and Samoa and everything. So
that's why it's called, a lot of people call it the Great War, but it's also called, and Germans started calling it a World War because of its reach. It was a global war, multiple continents.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it was different names, Go ahead.
So Wilson gets reelected in 1916 narrowly, not by much.
Right.
In fact, I looked at the results. California, he won by about 4,000 votes. It had California gone the other way, he would have lost. So he barely wins on the slogan of he kept us out of war.
Right.
And so that's November 1916. And by spring, or was it February or spring 1917, we're declaring war against Germany. How did we get such a dramatic reversal?
Like I said, there was a lot of talk to go into the war. I mean, there was a camp, you know, saying let's get into the war, and we were getting prepared for the war. When I say camp, and I mean just like a group of certain political leaders or people, business interests, and we should really get into the war. But there's, when I say camp, also I think of the preparedness movement and starting in Plattsburgh, New York, and I think also in California. But the preparedness movement that was started in 1915, because these army officers and there were civilians who were concerned about what might happen, that we may be getting to this war. And we just don't have the military establishment for it. We need to start training officers and all that. So that's the Plattsburgh movement, what it's called for Plattsburgh, New York. And that's kind of one of the things going on. Another thing that happened in 1915 was the sinking of the big ocean liner, the Lusitania.
Right.
The was a White Star, the Lusitania line that was carrying, they said this
a large
was
amount
a
of
neutral. The British said it was just a neutral ship, and we're just carrying people to Britain. It left New York and was heading for, I believe it was Liverpool or Southampton. And anyway, it was sunk off of Ireland by a German submarine. So they torpedoed the thing and sank in like 20 minutes, and there were some famous people, rich people, like the Vanderbilts were on it. It's kind of like the Titanic, but a few years later. So this huge ship goes down, but it did carry munitions. The Germans said, you're carrying war material, and this is this contraband, and we've got to do what we got to do in order to win the war. That's what they're saying. So we're gonna sink these ships. We're aware of this, and the British said it didn't, but it did have rifle cartridges. So anyway, the Germans kind of backed off of that because there were about 130 Americans who died on that ship. So that was outrageous. And so there was more people saying, you know, we got to do something about this. We can't tolerate this. It's an act of war. And Wilson was still trying to stay neutral. And then the Germans, they backed off of that. But then in January 17, they declared unrestricted submarine warfare, which is because they were getting to a terrible position with the British blockade, specifically the British Navy blockading German ports, so they couldn't receive goods, they couldn't receive food or and other things, and they were just starving. And this wasn't going to last much longer. So and at the same time, the Germans were torpedoing as many British ships and French ships as possible to make them give up soon, to just prevent the supplies getting to them, and then they would have to be forced to quit the war. So in January 17, they said, no, unrestricted warfare, we're just going to attack anything. We have to do this. And that didn't sit well with Wilson. So that, you know, they're going to attack U.S. ships and all that. And they had attacked some merchant ships and even some naval ships, and I can't think of the names offhand, and they attacked some. There's other incidents of that, of being attacked by subs for British ships or whatever. So they did this. Germany did that, and then Germany also did what was called the Zimmermann telegram. Germany also initiated that, where they sent a telegram, and the telegram system had been already tapped into by the British from the start of the war. And the Russians helped with this to provide intelligence, and the British naval intelligence already was reading these cables from like the beginning of the war and had decoded all the codes and everything. So, and this is kind of like what happened in World War II. So the Germans, anyway, they were asking Mexico to join the war, and they even went ahead and started initiating talks with Japan. They said, Mexico, would you join if you attacked the United States, and we would help you out, you know, we'd mutually help each other, and you could get back this territory in the Southwest that you lost in the Mexican-American War. And Texas, I think, included Texas or the Alamo and everything. So, you know, this came to light, and it was shown to Wilson, and this was like the tipping point, you know. So you had these two policies that the Germans implemented that just backfired, and or initiatives, whatever, that just backfired. And then, you know, this started the everything rolling towards war. And Selective Service, all this was kind of thought about at the time, having a draft and all this. There was already a National Defense Act.
Let me interrupt. You know, I'm sorry. There's the saying, you don't mess with Texas. I guess that might be part of it. Yeah, but also, you don't mess with your producer, and we have to take a short break, right? We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.fm and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.fm.
Content Marketing World 2018 comes to Cleveland, Ohio, September 4th through the 7th. Learn more at contentmarketingworld.com. Content Marketing World 2018 is the one event where you will learn and network with the best and brightest in the content marketing industry. Content Marketing World will have over 120 sessions and work.
It's time once again to get ready for the 35th Annual Miami Book Fair, November 11th through the 18th. Learn more at miamibookfair.com. Over 500 authors will be coming in from all over the world to read their books, answer questions from the audience, and sign autographs. Award-winning luminaries confirmed to attend this year include novelists like Elliot Ackerman, Robert Olin Butler, Ingrid Rojas Contreras, and Deborah Dean. Nonfiction writers like Dr. Mark Agronin, Muhammad Al-Samawi, Andrea Barnett, and Tina Brown. Celebrities like Justine Bateman, Steve Kornacki, Bill Press. These are just a few of the confirmed 500 authors scheduled to appear at the 2018 Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Check out the full schedule of events right now at miamibookfair.com. That's miamibookfair.com.
Blog, blog. blog.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're the talk of the town.
WebmasterRadio.fm. Thanks for listening.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking about World War One, and really, what lessons can we draw from it? We have as our guest Jonathan Casey. He's the director of archives and Edward Jones Research Center at the National World War One Museum and Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri. And so we only have a little bit of time left. And I guess what are the big, when people come to your museum and they walk away, what are the big takeaways? Or what do you think people should, you know, as we have the centennial coming up next month in November, I mean, what should people really know about World War One that you think maybe they don't know?
I think just our part in it, if you're going to say just the United States part, I think the overall efforts and what was involved in fighting this war, and not just from the military point of view, not just military operations, which we explain a lot, we show a lot of that, but just the civilian side, how it's affected, just the people who weren't the soldiers and all, what they were doing as part of the war effort in supporting it, and then there were those who didn't support it. There was dissent, you know, there was that was there, that was a part of the whole experience, but I think it's just it's a complicated story, and what people kind of understand maybe that the politicians have too much power. They just they would just be needing to have some type of a control on them, and that's what, you know, we think within our system we could do that, but we've ended up in other conflicts. We thought, you know, this would be the war to end all wars. People were saying that just to be idealistic, right. I think, and to be hopeful. And you'll see that, and you know, you see the phrase "the war to end war," and that was more like this would be so devastating, we would get smart, you know, the human race, and say this is, we can't keep doing this. We're going to destroy ourselves. And so that phrase is kind of around even prophetically even before the war. But I think coming out of it, you know, there was a legitimate attempt to try to solve some problems, and there's this League of Nations came out of the war that would be today's United Nations that came out of World War II, and just some way of trying to control the activities, military activities, and these things I mentioned, like the arms race, and somehow just to control, put controls on them. And there was success with that, with naval ships. Right. Warships. There were controls put on those. There was a treaty signed in the 20s that contained the size of these ships, because these were some of the big weapons of war at the time. These dreadnoughts, these huge warships, and all their armaments and everything. And so there was some control put on that. And after World War One, there was control put on the Germans specifically, and trying to keep them as really so that they couldn't be another major military power. And you know, things changed. But I think people, just the average person going through here, just seeing that all this happened, and that maybe if other decisions had been made, if the politicians, if the leaders had worked it out, you know, and not instead of going right to the weapons and right to having a military solution to something, maybe they, you know, this could have happened, but. And
you see that, yeah. That's kind of where Wilson's coming from on. You know, yeah. We need a League of Nations. And what's interesting, what I find relevant today, is that you have this, an idealistic intervention to an extent. You know, obviously there was an economic, you know, Germany was threatening our shipping channels. But, you know, going in to make the world safe for democracy, that was part of Wilson's declaration of war. And then you see this post-war view of Wilson, the 14 points, creating this international structure of the League of Nations and the United States as a leading actor on the world stage and working with alliances to help this happen.
Right.
And then you have a year later, the treaty can't get confirmed right. in the Senate. And you see this right. there's this retrenchment of the United States. You know, should we be on the world stage? Should we just focus on yeah. our borders? And this yeah. Belief and distrust at the same time of these international yeah. institutions, as we see this week as at the United Nations with President yeah. Trump's speech. And so it's almost yeah. it's full circle.
It's full circle. Yeah, that's a good point to make. What's in contemporary? What's happening now? We thought about making the war relevant, and how is it relevant to today? Well, this is the thinking. Now we're back in almost that same thinking about nationalist thinking and focusing, like you just said, focusing on us or whatever country. And I think President Trump said, it's okay. Everybody else. That's they have to think about themselves first. I think
right.
you know what's important to them, and turning aside the European Union and all that. Why we have the EU and why we have NATO and all that was a way of trying to control these military impulses. That occurred throughout history. I mean, these people looking back over hundreds of years and saying that it's not working, and the wars got more and more destructive. World War II ends with nuclear weapons, and
right.
the next step is let's have a third world war, which is nuclear weapons.
Right.
Destroy the whole planet.
And you mentioned the whole world war to end all wars, and I saw some quote that the only people who have seen the end of the war are the dead. They're
yeah,
the only ones dead. Who will see no more war.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It will happen. And so we only have 2 minutes left. And if you could
sure.
Just single out, who was your favorite hero of the war? And by the way, I should note, speaking of Missouri, the only
yeah.
U.S. president to serve in World War I was President Truman.
Was Harry Truman. You're right.
Yeah.
But
if
Harry
you had
Truman.
One hero, since we only have a minute left, who would you pick?
That's difficult. And I mean, there's they're the ones that are show that their prowess in battle or something, like an Alvin York, or their skills
right.
are like we have a Medal of Honor recipient, John Barkley, who was from Missouri, and he did to be awarded the Medal of Honor, shows courage and everything like that, and that's necessary. And maybe Harry Truman is a good example. I mean, it's somebody, he did his part. I think there's so many heroes in a way. We don't like to use that word. It's just so many people who did serve, did their duty, gave it their all, and were wanting to, it's interesting, but so many people just wanted to go back to civilian life. I think then kind of all the heroes, it's kind of like the greatest generation for World War I, then, these people went and did
right.
their duty, and millions of men and women, and came back and said, I want to just continue with my life and build a life and help build the country. So they could be seen as heroes or as obviously upstanding citizens. And, I think that's important, very important. But Truman is, to someone known, Truman is good, a good example that he did his part. He came back and built his life and his career, but then served and was on all kinds of positions, and the highest being the president. And he had to deal with very serious issues of war and peace and everything we were talking about in the creation of this new world post. The post World War II nuclear world and all. So,
right.
He's one. He would be a good example. But I just think everyone who served honorably and made it through those, and you think about those who didn't either. So, I guess that's, to use the word hero, like I said, we don't really use that. It's just something more of like from what you think about from movies or something.
Sure.
A hero, but we try to honor everybody in their service.
Right.
Here that's the point.
And I guess particularly the dead. And I'll give the last
yeah.
words to the poet. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Field.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you very much for helping us try to get our arms around this big topic, and good luck with your
yeah.
centennial celebrations. It is an important war. And then there's a lot to it. There's a great PBS series on it,
right.
The Great War.
Right.
It's a three-part series over 6 hours, which I highly recommend. And so best of luck to you in the memorial. I hope to get out there at some point.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your time. And
you're welcome.
And we have links to the website and the Twitter account for the memorial. And so as we reach the centennial, just maybe take some time to learn a little bit about this very important moment in American history. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Cyber Law and Business Report. Follow us on Twitter at Cyber Law Radio and on the web at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. And as always, check out the Internet Law Center at internetlawcenter.net. This is Bennett Kelly. Have a great week. Thank you.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.